Major support for Out to Lunch is provided by the law firm of Jones Walker, established in 1937 with over 375 attorneys in offices throughout the U.S., providing a comprehensive range of services to a local, national, and international client base. JonesWalker.com. And by Tulane SOPA, the Tulane School of Professional Advancement, offering online programs designed for working professionals who want to earn a certificate, complete their degree, or begin their graduate studies. Professional advancement begins at sopa.tulane.edu.
From Collins on St. Charles Avenue in Uptown New Orleans, we're out to lunch with Peter Ricchiuti, Tulane University A.B. Freeman School of Business professor and director of the Birkenroad Reports. It's business, New Orleans style.
Hi, I'm Peter Ricchiuti. Welcome to Out to Lunch. In the world of American coffee culture, 1971 changed everything. That was the year Starbucks was born. For much of the country, Starbucks was the first coffee shop in their town. In New Orleans, our first coffee shop opened in the French Market in the late 1700s. For a city not known for being on the cutting edge of business, we were 200 years ahead of the coffee game. Today, we're the country's second biggest coffee importer after New York City. In part, that's because we're the home of the coffee giant Folgers, but New Orleans has always been and still is a hub of green coffee markets. Green coffee is raw, unroasted coffee beans. It's the world's second largest traded commodity, second only to oil. One of the major players in the green coffee market is International Coffee Corporation. Besides importing and shipping beans, they do something called Q grading. Q grading is a specialized skill performed by people trained in the art of coffee tasting. People like my lunch guest, Drew Cambray. As sustainability manager at International Coffee Corporation, on an average day, Drew will sample and grade 20 to 40 different coffees. Drew Cambray, welcomed out to lunch.
Thanks for having me.
We drink a lot of coffee in the United States, but we drink around three times as much beer. The reason we drink all this beer is partly because it tastes good, but it's also for the feel-good effect alcohol has on our brain. Well, now there's another drink that's competing with beer for both taste and mood altering, and it's not alcohol. It's cannabis, THC to be exact. THC is the chemical in cannabis that gets you high. One of the country's fastest growing manufacturers of THC sodas is a New Orleans company called Crescent Canna. Crescent Canna was already manufacturing and selling THC-based products when it launched its drinks division in 2022 and saw its fortunes radically improve. Today, Crescent Canna has a lab and brewery in North Carolina, a head office in New Orleans, sales in over 1,000 locations in 20 states, online sales in all 50 states, and the company's CEO, Joe Garrity, says the company is negotiating with major distributors with the goal of becoming the Budweiser of THC drinks. Joe Garrity, welcome out to lunch.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Drew, sipping cups of coffee all day for a living sounds like a pretty good job description, but the results of your work as a Q grader have real-world consequences. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what those are. I mean, exactly. You are judging the taste of coffee for labeling purposes. For example, this is an acidic French roast, and this is a smoky Italian roast. Or are you rating coffee and coffee beans for their sale value? In other words, are you determining the cost of a coffee based on its taste?
So a little bit of both, to be honest. In my line of work, we focus on the before it's roasted at a professional coffee roaster level. So we are mainly the people who are trying the coffee and tasting the coffee to make sure that what the producer and the farmer and all over the world, so Brazil, Vietnam, and everything in between, pretty much matches what they say they're gonna sell us and deliver it to us. So we have customers who have different flavor profiles that they have to match, and part of our job is to just make sure that our customers' orders are satisfied. So if something happens in a country, say there's a flood or a frost or COVID, we can kind of come in, use our expertise, and give them alternatives to make sure that their end product is always the same.
Give me a chronology. They're grown in one of these countries. Do you get shipped the green beans?
Right. So the general chronology of coffee, pretty much from seed all the way to cup, is going to be a farmer is going to grow the coffee. Then at that point in time, it's usually multiple farmers get together and they kind of put all their crops together. And then they sell it off to a milling processing station, which is going to take the coffee from the little cherry. It almost looks like a cherry tomato. They're going to go through a whole bunch of processes with the coffee until eventually it's hulled, shelled, and then dried, and then processed a little further to where it's a green unroasted coffee bean. At that point in time, sales are made. So either a farmer or a mill or a co-op can sell them directly to a coffee shop or to a roaster. People like us come in where we will buy a bunch of different coffees from all over. And then we buy it. We make sure it gets on a boat in the country of origin. From there, we basically sample that coffee in what's called a pre-shipment sample. So we say, okay, this coffee, before it gets on a boat, tastes exactly like this. We'll make notations pretty much on everything of the coffee. Then when it arrives in anywhere from 2 weeks to a few months, we will then sample that coffee again at the port of entry. So be it New Orleans, be it Jacksonville, New York, wherever, we'll try that coffee. And so that at that point in time, we compare that arrival sample, is what it's called, to the pre-shipment sample and make sure that they match. And that pretty much just guarantees everything. And then from there, we sell to our customers.
Drew, I knew you were going to be articulate. I thought you'd be more wired.
No. I only had two cups of coffee today.
Okay. So now, Joe, everybody hopes that they launch the new product that's going to take off and be a smash hit. But the occasions when that actually happens are rare. Even Amazon, Apple, and Tesla took years before they were successful. But overnight success is pretty much what happened when you launched your THC drink, Crescent 9 THC Seltzer. You're now talking about strategies to grow Crescent Canna into the biggest THC drink supplier in the country. Driven that you're drawing a comparison with Budweiser, even if that's more aspirational than actual at this point, are you following a playbook similar to Budweiser or other drink distributors who have achieved market dominance? Or because of the product, are you confined to following a business plan that tracks with the legalization of marijuana across the country?
That is a complicated question. Budweiser is an institution in this country. They've been around for well over 100 years. We cannot follow the same playbook to success because I'd like to see success before I die. That being said, we're fortunate that there is already an engaged, demanding market for THC products in the country. And for the most part, they have been securing those products from the black market. Because of the 2018 Farm Bill, we're able to provide these products in a legal, tested, safe way that most consumers in this country are still unable to access through the black market.
Now, Joe, just because a lot of people don't know that legislation in 2018, what was that about? It wasn't exactly what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, it is, though, because the 2018 Farm Bill legalized hemp, and it restricted but allows very blatantly the consumption of Delta-9 THC, which is the active component in marijuana that makes you high. It is also found in hemp, and through extraction methods, we're able to take it from hemp, which is a federally legal product, and put it into food and beverages. The result of that is that we can mass produce beverage products and sell them through traditional distributors on the alcohol side. So what this country is seeing a lot of right now is a decline in alcohol consumption. That is, in my opinion, largely unrelated to marijuana. It is the demographics just changing. Younger people drink less. Older people are starting to try to reduce their alcohol consumption. And if you talk to any beer or alcohol distributor in the country, you'll see that they're suffering from the decreased alcohol consumption. What we're hoping, and what they're hoping in a lot of cases now as they've started to come around, is that this will take the place of the missing revenue that they have. We already know that people use cannabis. Through our exposure to the market in New Orleans and other states, we know there's demand for this stuff, and not just pennies. These are significant numbers we're talking about for distributors, and they are starting to become more eager to bring products like ours online.
Drew, one thing is, you mentioned a sustainability manager is part of your job. Is that the The thing I always see at coffee shops, a sign that we're a fair trade coffee shop. How do you do that?
Correct. So sustainability is extremely important right now, not just in coffee, but in anything, to be honest. So my main job is to just make sure that all of the sustainability organizations, so Fair Trade, USA, Organic, Rainforest Alliance, 4C, it goes on and on and on. My main goal is just to make sure that International Coffee is complying with all those rules and regulations, and therefore we need to make sure that all of our producers comply as well.
In the U.S., one of the big problems we have is that large corporations have become really the leaders, the dominant market share in farming. Is that what you fear in these smaller coffee growing countries?
So yes, that's a huge fear. And I think the biggest aspect of that fear is the fact that they have tons of muscle and financial muscle to push things around. And a lot of people don't realize that coffee is a commodity and it's traded as a commodity on the stock exchange. You can go buy stock in coffee right now if you want. Some of these corporations are so large that they can literally buy up stock and buy up futures to the point where they actually change the market. And then they can sell at the high point, make a whole bunch of money, and then crash the entire market. This actually happened back in the 90s for a company that will remain nameless, that is not mine, that completely crashed the Robusta market, which Robusta is basically the lower grade of coffee. So they completely changed the entire market and put a hurting on the entire coffee industry.
You're listening to Out to Lunch. I'm Peter Ricciuti. I'm talking with Drew Cambray, coffee expert, coffee taster, and sustainability manager at International Coffee Corporation, and Joe Garrity from New Orleans cannabis company Crescent Canna. Among other products they make is a line of THC sodas, including Crescent 9 THC Seltzer. We'll continue our conversation when we come right back from this short break.
Out to Lunch is brought to you by Basics Underneath, fine lingerie, personalized fitting, curated swimsuits and workout wear, Uptown on Magazine Street, and at basicsunderneath.com. And by Infinite Health Integrative Medicine Center, specializing in longevity, health optimization, and regenerative medicine. More information at yourinfinitehealth.com. And by Tracy Moore, broker, realtor, and partner at Rev Realtors, offering over 20 years of experience representing buyers, sellers, and investors. Learn more at tracy.revrealtors.com.
You're listening to Out to Lunch. I'm Peter Ricciuti. I'm talking with Drew Cambray, coffee expert, coffee taster, and sustainability manager at International Coffee Corporation, and Joe Garrity from New Orleans cannabis company Crescent Canna. Among other products they make is a line of THC sodas, including Crescent 9 THC Seltzer. Joe, like a lot of companies, you probably did a lot of front-end marketing, consumer focus groups, but when it actually came out, you were wrong at kind of who really would be your market, right?
We were. We expected this was going to be extremely appealing largely to the younger demographic. And as it turns out, it's the older demographic who is making up a significant chunk of our sales. It's people like my mother, people like my in-laws, some of the older gentlemen that I golf with, who are just trying to get away from drinking so much. They're looking for a more healthy alternative with fewer calories and no alcohol, and something that's still going to give them a pleasant buzz to enjoy their evenings.
I guess the one thing with cannabis is that you don't wake up hungover wanting to cut your head off. That's one of the benefits.
Yeah, there are certainly quantities of cannabis you can consume where the next day you're feeling groggy. We largely sell low potency products, and I would say that 99% of people I speak with say that they do not get hangovers from THC products like they do with alcohol.
And Drew, I'm trying to think of, it's more I was reading about your organization, I thought of more of the issues you have to face. Like one of them has to be climate change, right?
Correct. Climate change is huge, not just in coffee, but pretty much everywhere. So all of the coffee producing in the entire world is in what we call the coffee belt. So in between both of the tropics, barring a small little difference here and there. But so all of the coffee that is produced is within those tropics. And as we know, that's an area that is extremely hot and subject to hurricanes and droughts and all kinds of things. And so one of the main issues that we're facing right now is that a lot of these people who have been growing coffee for generations, all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, within the past, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, have noticed that maybe their yields are a little lower, or maybe their crops are now subject to some new pest or some new bacterial infections that are happening with the coffee. And that was never the same. That was never the way. So these people are having to either change their crop completely, or they're having to move. You know, coffee is being grown in different areas where it never really was before. And that's only going to get a whole lot worse as the years go by, unless, you know, we as an entire world change.
And Drew, these movements you're talking about, would it be generally north and higher that they would need to?
For coffee, higher. Coffee as a plant, actually, the more it struggles, the better it tastes, which is kind of weird, right? So you see a lot of the better coffee that is grown in higher elevations or in volcanic rocky soil. And then in some countries like Yemen, for example, if you ever look at pictures of coffee being grown in Yemen, it's literally on the side of a cliff. And there's enough room for a coffee tree and a dude to basically tiptoe and pick coffee cherries off. So it is going, you know, higher in elevation and a little more, I guess, spread away from the equator. But it can only spread so much before it starts encroaching on other crops, right? And then everybody's fighting for the same amount of soil, the same amount of arable land.
And Joe, you're in a position which is an envious position of kind of being ahead in this industry, but that usually brings up its own set of problems. In order to stay ahead, usually takes capital and hiring the right people. Is that kind of the stage you're in?
Yes. We've been very, very fortunate with our employees thus far. Our retention is, I don't want to say 100%, but everyone important has stuck around. We've offered vesting options for the employees to get a share of the company if they stay with us for a few years. And as such, it really feels like what we're doing is ours, not mine, not the investors, but everybody who's involved. Additionally, finding capital and scaling is difficult. It's hard to go from making 20,000 cans or so in a week to making 2 million cans in a month. And as such, we've had to use companies that are traditionally in the alcohol space to manufacture our product for us at scale. Fortunately, as you mentioned, alcohol sales are down, and these companies are searching for the next thing. And we have been welcomed with open arms with some of the biggest co-packers in the country that are looking at companies like ours as the future of canned beverages.
See where you come from, co-packers, but not necessarily Budweiser itself. You're eating away at that same pie. Should I look at it that way?
To some extent. So Budweiser does most of their own manufacturing, I believe. They also produce at such an insane scale that it's hard to even fathom for someone like me, who I'm thrilled if we sell a million cans in a month. If Budweiser sells a million cans in a day, it's like the worst day they've ever had. So it's definitely an interesting place for us to be. And one of the challenges with scaling is projections, because we're working with a product that has really never existed before. And it's hard to look at almost anything as a model. We know that in Louisiana, for example, we'll sell 400,000 cans next month, let's just say. If we sign on with the biggest liquor distributor in another state that's bigger and has substantially more salespeople and touches more accounts, it's very difficult for us to project what sales actually looks like 1 month, 3 months, 6 months down the line. So we're in a position where we have to produce a lot more than we expect to sell, because the last thing we want to do, which is something that happened in 2023 a handful of times, is run out of product. Demand is great, but not being able to satisfy that demand is obviously not an enviable position for us or our distributors to be in with their clients.
I have to ask you a question, because it seems a bit complicated. Where does Louisiana stand on all that?
Louisiana is a very interesting state because we were one of the first, if not the first in the country, to largely legalize these products and regulate them. We have a fairly robust hemp industry on the retail side of things. Every store that sells cannabis or hemp products, which are cannabis products, is required to get a permit through the ATC. Every single product that is sold that contains hemp in this state is required to go through an approval process with the Louisiana Department of Health, which requires labeling requirements, testing requirements, and compliance requirements for the company itself. And distributors also, who we work with in the alcohol and tobacco industries, have to acquire a hemp-specific distribution permit as well. So it's a very regulated market in this state, and frankly, it should be a model for the rest of the country. And I've said this before to other people, but it really should be the model that as this country moves forward toward mass legalization of marijuana, this is the type of system that works for that as well, and other states should be looking to emulate. It greatly benefits the consumer because it keeps prices low. It's not overly burdensome. It provides a free market for new businesses to come in without requiring lobbying to get permits. You may know that Louisiana marijuana market is in the medical side. They have a handful of dispensaries. Prices are astronomical compared to what the actual cost to produce these products are. And ultimately, the consumer suffers and the state suffers because a free market is going to provide more value to the consumer, to the state, both in terms of their in terms of their options as well as in terms of the financial gain.
And Drew, I remember when I think of coffee shops like kind of in the 60s, I thought of a guy with a guitar and people snapping their fingers. And is that kind of where the movement started?
In the United States, that's where the movement started. Coffee shops have been going back forever. You know, Italy, France, Belgium, Switzerland, all of these places. But in the U.S., it pretty much started there. And that's what the industry calls the first wave of coffee. And that first wave of coffee was pretty much exactly as you said. It was a guy or a girl behind the counter with a pot of coffee, and it was more about reading books and listening to music and talking to people. And back, I would say, around the 80s or so, as you mentioned, Starbucks came around, and they changed everything. A lot of people ask me, you know, what's your feeling on Starbucks? I'm sure you don't like them because their coffee is over-roasted and dark and whatever. Yeah, but if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have a job right now. They made it acceptable for people to drink larger amounts of coffee and then spend more on their average cup of coffee. And from that has just blossomed this entire industry. And it keeps on going and going. And so Starbucks, their big thing with the second wave was to make coffee more accessible. And you can have your coffee exactly how you want it. You can have, you know, 7.5 pumps of vanilla with 2 Splendas, half milk, you know, half soy milk, half whatever. And that's how it kind of expanded. And then from there, at that point in time, basically around the 90s or 2000s, we then kind of merged into the third wave of coffee. And the third wave of coffee is kind of what people think in their mind when they think of a barista, right? So they think of a person behind the counter who's making, pulling espresso shots, making latte art, really studying about coffee and studying about why we drink coffee and why a coffee tastes good, and kind of going a little bit, or I should say a lot of bit, further and deeper into coffee. So those people definitely are, it's a profession, you know, whereas with the Starbucks world and the second wave of coffee, it was more like a job. But now there are professional baristas who go to competitions, who, you know, help companies expand and grow and really fine tune their entire coffee program.
And I've got to tell you, I really enjoyed this, that you were one of the founders of the New Orleans Baristas Association, which was a Society of New Orleans Baristas, which the acronym is SNOB.
Correct.
Yes, that is.
It was definitely a tongue-in-cheek. It was definitely a tongue-in-cheek thing, right? Because New Orleans coffee shop history and culture has always been working class, right? We are a working class city. And we've always been tongue-in-cheek. Look at all of our Mardi Gras parades, Crew de Vue, and everything. We kind of poke fun at ourselves. So, yeah, we started. It was basically myself and a friend of mine, Kirk. It was literally at a bar on a bar napkin, and we were kicking around names, and we said, why not go with it? Society of New Orleans Baristas Snob. And so we kind of got together every week, every month, and there was about six or seven of us, and we were the first people in the city to really start taking the science of coffee a little more seriously and latte art. And now it's just blown up. You can't, you know, walk down the street without seeing an amazing coffee shop or micro roasters or whatever. And that's absolutely fantastic. Kind of, you know, kind of makes me feel a little good. I'm aging myself, but, you know, kind of like the grandfather or the uncle of coffee, of, you know, third wave coffee in the city. And it goes unsung, but it's nice.
Now I'm trying to figure out if there's a real connection between Drew and Joe. What about, like, your sodas, Joe? I mean, is there like caffeine in it as well?
So the first product that we launched, our tropical flavor, does have caffeine. And we did that for a few reasons. One, as Drew will attest, people love caffeine. Secondly, we were concerned that we would not be able to get into bars and music venues because the owners have concerns that people will drink one of these and go to sleep. And we decided, let's put some caffeine in this thing so people get a nice little kick from the caffeine and they get the mild buzz of the low potency THC product. And it has been a hit. And down the line, our second product, the biggest complaint we had about our first one was that it has caffeine. It's also one of the things people like most about it. So our second product that we came out, a ginger lemonade, has no caffeine. And that's probably more of a bedtime drink, in my opinion.
And you could combine that. If you had them both, you'd be quieter and more subtle with Joe's product. And Drew, you'd have people more excited, and you'd be going sideways if you did this.
Oh, definitely. I definitely think that both of our worlds kind of clash and combine in a very good way. One of the things about caffeine that and coffee that people have a problem with is the crash, right? They need another cup of coffee, or they'll slam, you know, an entire pot of coffee to study for their exams, and then they just keep on needing to drink it and drink it and drink it, and they clash.
And then I see them walking through campus. It's very scary.
Totally. And I definitely think that regulation of your own body chemistry, and everybody knows their own body correctly, I definitely think that is important. And previously, there was no legal way, I mean, other than alcohol, but alcohol gets you drunk and wasted, and that's definitely not good to go, you know, to take a test or take an exam if you're intoxicated.
Right. I'm gonna, I recommend
a little
that.
Shot of Jameson before a final.
Loosens
you up a
little. Just one or two.
God, yes. No. It's not something we advise, but that's an excellent, excellent point. Joe and Drew, none of us at this table have advanced degrees in medical science, but we do know that for survival, human beings have to stay hydrated. We could conceivably just drink water, but we long ago abandoned mere survival as our benchmark for human success. And that's why we have flavored drinks. Hundreds of years ago, New Orleans was one of the earliest American cities to import and sell coffee. Today, we're becoming one of the earliest American cities to manufacture and export THC-infused sodas. Drew, thanks for sharing some of your vast knowledge about coffee. And Joe, I look forward to following your company's continued success. Thank you both for taking the time to join me today on Out to Lunch.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Peter.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
My guests on Out to Lunch today have been Drew Cambray, Sustainability Manager at International Coffee Corporation, and Joe Garrity, CEO of Crescent Canna. We edited this show to fit into the time slot here on WWNO. You can hear our unedited conversation and find out more about Drew's coffee and Joe's cannabis by listening to the Out to Lunch podcast. You can find and subscribe to the Out to Lunch podcast on your podcast app and on our website, itsneworleans.com. If you want to know what we all look like, you can find photos from this show on itsneworleans.com and on our Out to Lunch social media. These photos were taken today by Jill LaFleur. You can find more of Jill's photos at LaFleurPhoto.com. Out to Lunch is a production of INO Broadcasting for itsneworleans.com and WWNO 89.9 FM. The producer of our show is Grant Morris. Our technical producer is Eric Merle. Our researcher is Amy Irvin. I'm Peter Ricchiuti. Thanks for joining me. I look forward to meeting you again next week around the lunch table for more business, New Orleans style, on Out to Lunch.
Out to Lunch was recorded live at Collins on St. Charles Avenue. Collins serves lunch and dinner 7 days a week, hosts weddings and private events, features evenings of live jazz and more. Reservations for dining and hotel rooms are at thecollins.com. Collins is a member of New Orleans & Company. More information at neworleans.com. Major support for Out to Lunch is provided by the law firm of Jones Walker, established in 1937 with over 375 attorneys in offices throughout the U.S., providing a comprehensive range of services to a local, national, and international client base. JonesWalker.com. And by Tulane SOPA, the Tulane School of Professional Advancement, offering online programs designed for working professionals who want to earn a certificate, complete their degree, or begin their graduate studies. Professional advancement begins at sopa.tulane.edu. Mitchell Foreman wrote and performs all the music on Out to Lunch. You can hear Mitchell's music anywhere great jazz is sold or streamed, and at mitchellforeman.com. If you'd like to be part of Out to Lunch, to learn how your business or organization can become an Out to Lunch program partner, email info@inobroadcasting.com.